Hello, and welcome to the Learning College put on by Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your genial host, Alex Linder, and today we're going to do Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland, published in 2017, available at merchants-of-sin.com. You can buy it through Amazon or another place there. You can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com and often enough later on at alexlinder.com when it's permanently finished and archived. Today we're going to do chapter VIII or 8 on Jews and film, pages 125 to 147 of Merchants of Sin. So let's dig into it. This will be our penultimate session. We'll have one more to conclude the book. Merchants of Sin, chapter 8, Jews and film. Epigraph. As soon as the Jew gained control of the movies, we had a movie problem, the consequences of which are not yet visible. It is the genius of that race to create problems of a moral character in whatever business they achieve a majority. And that was Henry Ford from his researchers and the articles they put out over a couple of years in the Dearborn Independent. We've made an audiobook out of The International Jew, the world's foremost problem, which was the title given to the book made of those collected articles from the Dearborn Independent in the 1920-21 period. So Henry Ford says in some of those articles, the Jews came to this country in large numbers after 1880. They quickly moved to take over American stage and publishing, which were then in New York. And again, this is before the electronic age, but first they took over the American stage and made it bawdy, racy, sexy, compared to what it had been before there were American actors, and that it wasn't a dirty thing. That, and what Henry Ford is saying quite correctly is that Jews essentially dirty everything they touch. And we know from what we've heard the last couple of sessions of this book, talking about Wilhelm Reich and about Freud and the Frankfurt School, that Jews see that as a way to unstring and destroy Goy society, because they believe all Goyim, all whites, are budding Nazis. They all have authoritarian personalities as their default setting, and it has to be changed by Jewish media manipulators to loose, unstrung are the terms I generally use, but sexually loose society will reduce what they call anti-Semitism, which is the natural reaction to their behavior and their plots and their agenda, which is essentially parasitic genocidalism. If they're a parasite, they're a parasite that tries to kill the host, as their holidays reflect, celebrations of their triumph over ancient peoples they destroyed. And now they're trying to do the same to whites 2,000 years later. Anyway, Jews in film, it is the genius of that race to create problems of a moral character in whatever business they achieve a majority, said Henry Ford, his researchers. The movie industry, according to film historian Robert Sklar, S-K-L-A-R, the movie industry was, quote, completely in the hands of respectable established Anglo-Saxon Protestant Americans before Jewish immigrants began taking it over in 1911. Now, who invented movie technology? Well, whites did, Edison most notably. The Jews seized this technology and realized what could be done with it very early, and they went out to Hollywood partly to escape patent claims by Edison and to set up shop in a new warm area, and they created Hollywood out of nothing. And there are a number of Jewish books specifically talking about the Jews who created Hollywood. Neil Gabler, Ben Stein have written about it, a number of others. Any biography of some of the main players out there will also give you a picture of it. By 1915, the Jew Karl Lamel had crushed all of his competitors, L-A-E-M-M-L-E, that would be a German Jew name. By 1915, the Jew Karl Lamel had crushed all of his competitors using every dirty trick at his disposal and had become head of the largest studio, Universal. From this point on, Neil Gabler writes in An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, the Jews would control the movies, and much of what they did with Hollywood, they've done to U.S. politics proper and U.S. media and U.S. academia. There was great concern over the potential harm that movies could do to the public morality from the very beginning. In the same year that the Jews effectively took over Hollywood, 1915, the Supreme Court denied First Amendment rights to movies with Mutual Film Corporation versus Industrial Commission of Ohio. That's very interesting. In the same year that the Jews effectively took over Hollywood, 1915, the Supreme Court denied First Amendment rights to movies with Mutual Film Corporation versus Industrial Commission of Ohio. This decision gave local censors the right to screen movies before allowing their showing, making film the only medium ever subject to, quote, prior restraint, unquote, censorship in the history of America. Stop there. We're on 127. 126 is a full page graphic of the cover of An Empire of Their Own by Neil Gabler. He's a Jew writing about his subtitle, as it states, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. Harry Kahn, William Fox, Carl Lamel, Louis B. Meyer, Jack and Harry Warner, Adolf Zukor. So these would be the heads of the handful of studios that dominated the media, as a handful of Jews dominate social media today. You know, Zuckerberg and well, Dorsey's not a Jew with Twitter, but, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Quote, going back to the text, the exhibition of moving pictures is a business, pure and simple, the court declared. So we see that they had a much narrower interpretation and purely political and, I guess, printed press interpretation of the First Amendment. It did excluded obscenity, as we've heard and as this book is largely about, until Jews got the court decisions to liberalize and finally just simply effectively do away with obscenity laws by the mid-late 60s. Acknowledging that motion pictures could be used for good, such as for education, the judges also recognized that they may be used for evil, direct quote, especially since their audiences include not just men and women, but also children. The salient aspect of the history of the Jewish domination of our film industry in Hollywood is the lack of any open acknowledgement of the Jews as an ethnic group among their opposition. This is despite it being a well-known, obvious and despised fact that the Jews were using the movies for ill. For instance, the 1922 anti-Hollywood pamphlet, The Sins of Hollywood, the most popular of its time, describes a movie producer who is preying on a pretty aspiring actress as, quote, a small dark-haired with a bullet head and a low receding brow and a large nose and small ratty eyes. And as I'm reading you, the Harvey Weinstein scandal has been going on for a couple weeks now, so nothing changes. It was the same with Leo Frank. Jews will use their position of power to sexually aggress against goyish women and white women and blonde, blue-eyed women in particular. And even in 1922, they were publishing pamphlets acknowledging that, The Sins of Hollywood. Along with a suspiciously Yiddish-sounding accent he is given, that makes it pretty clear that the character is a Jew, yet he is never explicitly named as such. And there's footnotes documenting the stuff that we read in this book. Calling a Jew was out of the bounds of respectability, apparently even way back then. The one prominent American who had the courage to come forward and openly name and oppose the Jews was the great industrialist Henry Ford. His newspaper, the Dearborn Independent, which he distributed for free to hundreds of thousands of Americans every week, ran a total of 91 anti-Semitic articles. Three of them were concerning, quote, Jews and the movies. We flip over to 128 and there's a big picture, The Sins of Hollywood, an expose of movie vice, shows a literal devil, demon behind the camera focused down on a couple of cringing, like a 20s flapper and a man in a tuxedo. Price 50 cents, The Sins of Hollywood. On to 129, quote, there is little wisdom in discoursing against evil in the movies and deliberately closing our eyes to the forces behind the evil, one such article reads, one of Henry Ford's researchers. The purpose of this and succeeding articles, it continues, quote, is not to lift hands in horror and point out how rotten the movies are. Everybody is doing that. The case against the movies is not contested at all. It is unanimous. Women's clubs, teachers, newspaper editors, police officers, judges of the courts, ministers of religion, physicians, mothers and fathers, everybody knows just what the movies are. What all these disgusted groups evidently do not know is this. Their protest will be entirely useless until they realize that behind the movies there is another group of definite moral and racial complexion. A group of definite moral and racial complexion. They can go on beating the air for a lifetime and still obtain no improvement unless they face the unpleasant racial fact that the movies are Jewish. It is not a question of morals. That question has been settled. It is a question of management. And that could even be where Name the Jew originally came from, Henry Ford's people. Because he believed back then that exposing the Jew, another favorite, was enough. Now, it proved to be wrong. It's not enough. But it is still necessary. Necessary, but not alone sufficient. They thought if the Jew were named, the Jew would be shamed and embarrassed and clean up his act. But no, it's not the case. Brazenness is the heart of Jewish. It's not something peripheral to Jews. It's at the heart of Judaism, is aggressive lying. Back to the proper text. In 1921 alone, there were almost 100 bills introduced in 37 states calling for the regulation of motion pictures. So in 1922, the same year as the distribution of both Ford's articles and the Sins of Hollywood pamphlet quoted above, that they have the graphic of, the major Hollywood studios hired U.S. Postmaster General Will H. Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S, to head the newly formed Motion Picture Association of America, MPAA, which still exists, for the purpose of regulating film content in order to prevent a government crackdown. The MPAA drew up guidelines in the form of, quote, the formula in 1924, the, quote, don'ts and be carefuls, unquote, in 1927, so the formula and the don'ts and be carefuls in 1927, and finally the production code, in quotes, in 1930. So from the formula, don'ts and be carefuls, to finally, here's just a flat production code, here's the rules to follow in making movies. In 1930, over the course of, 6 years, from 24 to 30, they arrived at a production code by the MPAA that still exists today. Well, the ratings is what's replaced the production code. The production code is gone. So again, I'll just read that again. The MPAA drew up guidelines in the form of the formula in 1924, the don'ts and be carefuls in 1927, and finally the production code in 1930, which was not fully enforced until they hired Joseph Breen, Catholic, and formed the Production Code Administration in 1934. So over a decade, there's an agitated response. The Jews recognize they need to head that off, and they end up forming a production code, and then it gets some teeth when the Catholics really get into it. The period between the writing of the production code and its actual enforcement, 1930 to 1934, is what is known as pre-code Hollywood, during which producers were continuously pushing the moral boundaries of the time. In response, Catholics formed the Legion of Decency for the stated purpose of boycotting and condemning, quote, absolutely, those salacious modern pictures which, with other degrading agencies, are corrupting public morals and promoting a sex mania in our land, close quote. The Catholic Legion of Decency's threat of a boycott loomed heavily over the Hollywood Jews. This was no empty threat. On one occasion, they organized a protest in Philadelphia, and the profits for that city dropped by 40%. And I don't know if he quotes it in here, but one of these Jews was so worried by that boycott, he cried big tears as big as horse turds, I think was pretty close to what the quote was. And that alone, certainly no morality, got the Jew to bend to this production code. So for a few decades, they had to make undirty movies. Now, so they had a Breen was a prime example of Ford's complaint about the futility of people opposing Jewish behavior without ever naming them directly. And there was another example cited by E. Michael Jones when they were opposing, like, when the you won't realize it now, but contraception used to be, let alone abortion, used to be completely illegal, even in the most liberal states. And the Jews fought to get it legalized, and again, the Catholics weakly opposed them and wouldn't name their opponent. The Jews go directly after Catholics, but the Catholics don't have the balls to go directly after Jews. Blame the sin, not the, hate the sin, not the sinner, is weakness. Weakness. And so I'll read that again. Breen was a prime example of Ford's complaint about the futility of people opposing Jewish behavior without ever naming them directly as Jews. Breen, according to multiple private correspondences, was an anti-Semite, but he never dared to say it publicly. Weakness. In 1932, he wrote to a Jesuit confidant that the Jews are, quote, a rotten bunch of vile people with no respect for anything beyond the making of money. Here, in Hollywood, we have a paganism rampant and in its most virulent form. Drunkenness and debauchery are commonplace. Sexual perversion is rampant. Any number of our directors and stars are perverts. They mean homos and pedophiles as well as womanizers, as we'd use the term today. Harvey Weinstein, again, as I speak to you in 1917, you know, nearly 100 years ago, they were seeing exactly the same thing. So it's been that way all along from the very start. From out of the egg, Hollywood has been a perverse, vile, Jewish, nasty place. And so long as it exists, that will continue. Continuing in that quote, these Jews seem to think of nothing but making money and sexual indulgence, dot, dot, dot. 95% of these folks are Jews of an Eastern European lineage. They are probably the scum of the earth. And that was Breen in a private letter to a Jesuit. He wrote to his assistant, Martin Quigley, that same year, quote, "The fact is that these damned Jews are a dirty, filthy lot." 2 years later, again in a letter to a Jesuit, while referring to one movie official as, quote, "a kike Jew of the very lowest type," Breen claimed to be the one man, quote, "who could cram decent ethics down the throats of the Jews." Breen and the Legion of Decency did, in fact, effectively rein in the Jews' racial urge to promote degeneracy and immorality, at least for a time. So this giant majority is able to get this tiny minority to act semi-human for a few decades, but that's not really good enough, is it? The first serious, quote, chink in the code's armor, according to Leonard L. Jeff, basically they ran the code from, say, 34 up to like 65, and then they got rid of it. So it was like a corset on their immorality, with giant boobs and ass on either side of it, if you see what I mean. Just sort of a figure that jumped to mind. The first serious chink in the code's armor, according to Leonard J. Leff, Leff, and Gerald L. Simmons, in their History of the Production Code, The Dame in the Kimono, a book I have not read, The Dame in the Kimono, came with the movie The Bicycle Thief, which was imported from Italy by the Jew Joseph Burstyn in 1948. After viewing the film, Breen found two scenes objectionable and wanted them removed prior to the issuing of a seal. Both seem rather innocuous, especially by today's standards. One of the scenes showed a boy, filmed from the back, pausing to urinate on a wall before his father called him away, and another showed characters running through a brothel, though nothing even remotely explicit is shown. The former Breen considered toilet humor, which he categorically rejected. The latter he considered dangerous in that, quote, "such locales inescapably suggest commercialized vice and human depravity and arouse unwholesome interest and curiosity on the part of youth." Close quote. So those were two scenes he wanted removed from The Bicycle Thief, 1948. Burstyn skillfully whipped up controversy over this, knowing the film would rise in popularity accordingly. After it won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film, Breen, under pressure from multiple civil liberty organizations, the media, and even the Legion of Decency, finally backed down and gave it a seal without the recommended cuts. Breen's reasoning for wanting the scenes cut was the following. Quote, "If, for any reason whatsoever, such scenes are to be appraised as acceptable, such approval may be properly deemed to set a precedent for all future motion pictures. The motion pictures will be flooded with similar scenes." "A very prescient observation, I would argue," says Garland, "given the nature of what Jewish Hollywood films, especially comedies, have devolved into, now being filled front to back with almost nothing but, quote, toilet humor and, quote, human depravity." Joseph Burstyn was a Polish-born Jewish immigrant. He was initially a diamond polisher, but after making a decent enough turnover from a screening of the movie A Jew at War, he went into the business of exclusively importing foreign films. In 1952, 4 years after The Bicycle Thief, Burstyn again caused controversy when he imported another Italian film called The Miracle. And there's a picture of Joseph Burstyn, a big gap-toothed, not even particularly Jewy-looking type, but not a wholesome-looking type either, kind of a skinny gap-toothed. There's a British actor who's a little bit similar to him in facial appearance, and I don't know what his name is. And then opposite that we just passed, full page graphic on page 132, is a movie poster for The Bicycle Thief, I assume. It's a movie. Yeah, that would be a movie. Shows a kid with and father in rain. Father's wearing a hat, kind of a gaunt, frightened look, or worried or nervous or apprehensive look. And the kid has his coat pulled up over his head and is kind of grimacing. The tough times. Vittorio De Sica's The Bicycle Thief. Academy Award, Outstanding Foreign Language Film, 1949, written by Cesare Zavattini and Vittorio De Sica. Music by Alessandro Cicognini. Cinematography by Carlo Montuori. Produced and directed by Vittorio De Sica. A CFEX film, a Kino International release. One of the greatest films of all time. Pauline Kael, The New Yorker. She was probably the most famous movie critic back in the early 70s, a Jew who wrote in the New York media, and most famously said she couldn't understand how Richard Nixon won in that election in which he won 49 states. She didn't know a single person who voted for him. So if you think it's only rural whites who are parochial, you're wrong. We're all parochial. Now, moving below the picture of Joseph Burstyn on 133. Catholics protested The Miracle, Burstyn's next film, and blocked its showing in New York theaters because they found it to be blasphemous. Burstyn, spending more than $60,000 of his own money, over $500,000 in today's value, brought the movie to the Supreme Court, where it resulted in the landmark decision of Joseph Burstyn, Inc. v. Wilson, also known as the Miracle Decision, name of the film. The Miracle Decision overturned the Mutual Decision and freed movies from the burden of prior restraint. Films were not seen as, quote, a business pure and simple, close quote, anymore, as they were before, as decided in the Mutual Decision. They were freed from prior restraint, but as a medium worthy of full First Amendment protections. Films were not seen as a, quote, business pure and simple anymore, but as a medium worthy of full First Amendment protections. The movie was defended by the Jew Ephraim London, who was the uncle of the prominent Jewish feminist Robin Morgan. So you wouldn't think Robin Morgan was a Jew name, of the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, or WITCH, that we heard about last session. So when we're learning as part of the Learning College, whenever you see a place name as a surname, it's very often like Berlin or London or stuff like that. It's very often a Jew. An exception might be the name French, which is typically an Irish sort of name that you'd find in England or Ireland. But generally a city name is very often Isaiah Berlin. That's going to be a Jew very often. So once you see the pattern, you will know how to apply it, or you'll suspect, and you always have to verify it, but it's just a good thing to know about Jews camouflaging themselves. Now, we know that Ross and Green are typical, I don't know if they're Anglo or Celtic, but in any case, British type surnames, but have been adopted by a great many Jews. Think like even like Jack Black, the movie guy, is a Jew. And so I've never heard that Morgan was one of those, but evidently there are some who do have that name. You wouldn't think Robin Morgan is a very un-Jewy name, yet this Jewish feminist was a Jew. Now, so the movie was defended by Jew Ephraim London. London, who once opined on television, on a television show, that if people, quote, want to publicly perform intercourse on a nightclub stage or defecate or anything like that, close quote, they should be allowed. Ultimately argued nine film cases before the Supreme Court, the miracle being the first, and incredibly won them all. Then there's a big picture of Ephraim London. Sort of normal looking guy, not even really particularly Jewy. The production code's main nemesis was the Jew Otto Preminger, who actively and openly defied it repeatedly. Then we flip over to, or we look across to 135, and there's a big picture. Otto Preminger, along with being a producer and director, was also an actor, frequently typecast as Nazi heavies, sort of grunt, blunt, crude, potato-faced, German, vicious, aggressor, peasant-type Nazi, as opposed to sensitive, delicate, romantic, underdog, heroic, Jewy types. You've seen it a million times. Following the miracle decision, and that's a particular sort of irony a Jew would love. Like they get their ugly ass Jews to play Aryan Nazis and make them look, use their own bad looks to attack their good looking and racial enemy. That's exactly the kind of irony and chutzpah they love. Following the miracle decision, he submitted the script for The Moon Is Blue. And it was subsequently rejected by both the Legion of Decency and the Production Code Administration, with Breen accusing it of having, quote, an unacceptably cavalier approach toward seduction and illicit sex. Now, see, I'll just pause here a minute. If you're like me and you favor an incisive approach, this trying to stop the Jews from being dirty is like trying to stop water from pouring through any tiny little crack. That's what it fucking does. There's no use to doing any of this except getting rid of this whole tribe who think this way because you can't eradicate their mindset. You can't change their mindset. That is the Catholic fallacy. You can somehow convert these people to not being what they manifestly are, proved by their all recorded behavior. So my natural Aryan logical mind just immediately leaps. It's like the absurd. You know what? What's a parallel? It's like cops dealing with niggers. Why do you want to keep wiping up stuff when the only thing you could do that would actually be useful? Okay, you want to make your 20 years and make your pension. That's a private drive. But if you were actually trying to solve the crime problem, you would say, let's just get rid of this freaking criminal population. Among whites, it's a tiny minority that can be dealt with, but among blacks, it's practically the whole community is a criminal body. So why would you want to? It just doesn't make any sense. It's not a rational way to go about solving a problem. See, that's where Christianity nicely kicks in with its idea of the imperishable, eternal soul of inestimable value. Oh no, you can't look at comprehensive solutions like that that might actually work and solve the problem. You have to deal with each one individually. Like you can't kill any mosquito landing on you and sucking blood unless you consider it innocent until proven guilty and have a nice trial for it. Try to change its morals so it doesn't suck blood. I mean, it's absolutely just as absurd to try to get a Jew to change as a mosquito. All right. So Preminger is playing with the authorities and messing with them, breaking down barriers, all that good stuff Jews always do, and always in the same direction to make everything dirtier, cruder, nastier, sexually looser. Preminger went ahead with the film anyway, During the press conferences for it, he repeatedly slammed Breen for his, quote, hypocritical interpretation of an antiquated code, and foreshadowing the weapon the Jews would soon use to topple the code entirely, compared the very concept of censorship to Nazism. Quote, it is an evil institution, and if we give into it on a small matters, this is the first step toward the kind of totalitarian government that destroyed my country, Austria. So when we agree that the Nazis are evil, and then the Jews say, okay, everything that you like that's good, we'll just call that Nazi, and you'll agree with us that it needs to be destroyed because you're weak, freaking minded, weak-minded, gullible, weak people. And who can say they're wrong? Isn't our adoption of Christianity proof that we're weak people? I don't think a lot of white nationalists who imagine they can be Christians at the same time want to confront that. After having the film rejected by both Warner Brothers and Paramount for being, quote, too risky, Preminger convinced the Jews, Arthur Krim, K-R-I-M, and Robert S. Benjamin, to produce it unedited with their company, United Artists, and then released it without code approval. A full, quote, frontal assault on Joseph L. Breen, as Leffen Simmons put it. Following its release, The Moon is Blue was censored in many states and outright banned in three, Maryland, Ohio, and Kansas. Preminger and the United Artists took the Kansas ban all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where, with the help of Ephraim London, they got the decision reversed. The Moon is Blue, due to its success, in spite of not being code-approved, quote, sounded the death rattle of the Legion of Decency and the production code, wrote Leffen Simmons. Following the Miracle decision and the subsequent 1957 Roth decision, see Part 3, where they're trying to push smut in books and literature, independent filmmakers who were not bound by the production code, as the major studios in Hollywood were, began pushing the envelope by producing, quote, nudie cutie and, quote, sexploitation films. Beginning with Russ Meyer's The Immortal Mr. Tease, 1959, these were the first, quote, above-ground films to feature gratuitous nudity without being in the nudist or naturalist genre. They initially played in what were known as grindhouse theaters, but slowly moved into more mainstream ones. Next to Meyer, the Jew David F. Friedman is by far the biggest name associated with sexploitation, so Russell Meyer and David F. Friedman. In 1963, Friedman produced Scum of the Earth using the pseudonym Davis Freeman. Scum of the Earth is considered the first in the roughy subgenre of sexploitation. Roughies, in general, were violent revenge films. In the beginning, they would show a woman or multiple women being brutally raped or otherwise abused and tortured by men, and by the end, the men would be shown in the receiving end of the graphic violence. And this eventually turned into mainstream, like Last House on the Left and a few others like that. The sort of stuff that would inspire Tarantino, the grindhouse stuff, roughies, sexploitation. Also in 1963, Friedman produced Blood Feast, which is considered the first in the gore or splatter genre. Later in 1969, using the pseudonym Herman Traeger, Friedman produced Love Camp 7. This was the first film of the most bizarre sexploitation subgenre of all, Nazi-sploitation. Nazi-sploitation films were sexually explicit, gory, over-the-top horror fantasies, which were generally about cartoonish German Nazis conducting all kinds of deranged experiments on Jewish concentration camp inmates. The mother of all Nazi exploitation films was Ilse, She-Wolf of the SS, which was, again, produced by Friedman/Traeger. Here is part of the plot summary for Ilse, as found on Wikipedia, to give you an idea of how sick and weird these types of movies actually were. Block quote. Ilse is a commandant of a Nazi prison camp who conducts sadistic scientific experiments designed to demonstrate that women are more capable of enduring pain than men are. Ilse is also portrayed as a buxom woman with a voracious sexual appetite for men. Every night she chooses another of her male prisoners and rapes him. However, owing to her hypersexuality, she is disappointed when her current victim eventually ejaculates and promptly has him castrated and put to death. Only one American prisoner who can avoid ejaculating manages to use her weakness to his favor. Flip over onto 138, and there's a full-page movie poster for Ilsa, She-Wolf of the U.S., with giant tits spilling out of a three-button open top. The most dreaded Nazi of them all, a different kind of ex. She stands in front of a Swazi background. She committed crimes so terrible, even the SS feared her. Starring Diane Thorne as Ilsa, with Sandy Richman, Jojo DeVille, Uschi Dygaard, directed by Don Edmonds, produced by Herman Traeger, and Etas Film, AETAS, an Etas Film production, Color, a Cambist film release. Warning, some members of the public may find certain scenes in this film offensive and shocking. The management. Now in 139. In 1964, the Supreme Court again weighed in on the issue of film censorship with a highly significant landmark case, Jacobellis v. Ohio. Jacobellis v. Ohio. It was this case, which was over the showing of the French film Les Amants, The Lovers, where Justice Potter Stewart, when trying to define pornography, made the famous, oft-repeated, and mock statement, "I know it when I see it." The Jacobellis case, "I know it when I see it," which was again argued by Ephraim London, applied the liberal Roth test to film, meaning now, as long as the film had, quote, socially redeeming value, what was found in the Roth case to be necessary, and its, quote, overall effect was not to, quote, appeal to prurient interest, then it was legal and could not be suppressed. So Jacobellis uses the Roth test in literature for film. Local censors' hands were now tied somewhat by the Supreme Court. Hollywood, on the other hand, was still ultimately beholden to the Legion of Decency and the production code, and so it went into all-out assault on them both. In 1964 alone, the Legion faced by far more code-breaking films than any previous year. 34 films, direct quote, of which 20 were major Hollywood productions, Monsignor Thomas Little of the Legion reported at the time, quote, would have been released with scenes employing nudity had his organization not successfully pressured them to edit. There was one film that year that wasn't to be dismissed so easily, though, The Pawnbroker, which was centered around the Holocaust. The Jews cleverly weaved the nudity into scenes that they could claim were, quote, necessary to the movie, unquote. This being a Holocaust film, the moral responsibility for was entirely flipped on its head. The Jews were not in the wrong for wanting to put nudity in the big screen. The censors were in the wrong for condemning it. It was, quote, art, they argued, not smut. And the Holocaust is a deeply emotional topic for the poor, innocent Jews who had just suffered so much at the hands of the Nazis. We flip over and there's a movie poster of The Pawnbroker on page 140, a Sidney Lumet film, Rod Steiger, Geraldine Fitzgerald, 1965 Academy Award nominee, Best Actor, Rod Steiger. And there's a hand on a piece of paper, and slightly up on the arm is the old tattoo with a Jewish star, which is not where they did those tattoos anyway, but, you know, truth doesn't really matter when it comes to the Holocaust, since the whole thing is a big lie. Though thoroughly intimidated by the Jews' Holocaust guilt-tripping, the Production Code Administration and the Legion nevertheless both rejected The Pawnbroker, recognizing that allowing it would be the first step down a slippery slope. If we were to agree to that, how could we hold back the next one? Right quote. The Jews released the film anyway, uncut and without code approval, through Allied Artists, which was controlled at the time by the Jewish Mirisch family, M-I-R-I-S-C-H. The Jewish producer of The Pawnbroker, Eli Landau, then appealed the film to the board of the MPAA. The board overturned the prior ruling and awarded the movie a seal, claiming the, quote, sole exception granted The Pawnbroker is to be viewed as a special and unique case and in no way setting a precedent, close quote. Much as they ran full frontal male nudity on, I think it was NBC, when they showed Spielberg's bullshit film about the Holocaust. So the Jews are always getting special exceptions, and they're using their Jewish privilege to promote that which destroys Aryan society, always. How long are we going to continue to be a race of suckers? And I suggest to you the answer is so long as we remain mainly Christian. Then there's a photo showing the scene that they wanted to cut out but left in, a black prostitute, caption with a bar over her tits. Caption reads, "Negress prostitute in the pawnbroker, the first nude scene ever to pass code approval." And so when they let it in, they said, "This is not to set a precedent." This, of course, was nonsense, and everybody knew it. The pawnbroker exception set off a string of events that saw the production code completely abandoned within 5 years. It was replaced by the MPAA ratings system, which is still in use today, though it has been altered a bit throughout the years. Initially, the rating system was G for general, M for mature, R for restricted, and X for not rated. Michael Medved, with his book Hollywood versus America, another Jew who wrote about the stuff Gabler did, gives us many astonishing statistics about these crucial years, such as the following. Theater profits were a steady 40 to 49 million a week for 12 years prior to the beginning of the dissolution of the code, 1953 to 1965. The numbers then dropped from 44 million in 1965 to 17 million in 1969. How about that? So they don't put politics ahead of profits, or they don't put profits ahead of politics, they put politics ahead of profits, contrary to what the leftists always claim corporations do. So their agenda is Jewish specific, not capitalist purely. That is almost a full two-thirds loss of theater goers and profit. So it's not like they're losing 10%, they're losing like two-thirds when they went to, uncensored, non-general sex inclusion. Again, that is almost a full two-thirds loss of theater goers and profit. From 1966 to 1967 alone, it went from 38 million to 17.8 million, well over a 50% drop in 1 year. Medved goes on to provide data that prove unequivocally that G-rated movies make an overwhelmingly larger monetary return than others, more than twice as much as R-rated movies on average, with PG-13 and PG-rated movies falling pretty evenly in between. Yet the producers have continuously made more and more R-rated films and less G-rated ones, in spite of the millions upon millions, possibly billions, of guaranteed profits going out the window. Even foul language, Medved reveals, is shown to be rejected by, quote, huge majorities of potential moviegoers in innumerable surveys, direct quotes. Yet it has only, as we all well know, gotten more and more offensive over time, completely destroying the leftist school of corporate criticism as the way to corporations pursuing profits. That's how you understand what comes out of Hollywood, the leftists say. But they're not interested in evidence that proves over and over and over again that they're wrong. You could cite as many examples as you wanted to of that being true. Medved is a Jew himself, and as such, he is a staunch apologist for his tribe's role in Hollywood. He feigns ignorance as to why his own data shows what it does, choosing to place the blame on liberalism. But those of us with the PC blinders off, who are willing to deploy even a modicum of common sense, know there can only be one possible explanation for this phenomenon. The Jews are more concerned with demoralizing society and pushing their own ethnic and political agenda than they are in making profits. And we all know how much the Jews love profits, Garland says in italics, so they hate whites even more than they love money. Think about that. Those figures, and Medved's book in general, are in and of themselves proof that the Jews are using film as a weapon to deliberately attack the morality of Gentile society, just as they admittedly do with outright hardcore pornography, as we'll see in part 9, the closing session of this book. This is not conjecture by an anti-Semite, but an incontrovertible fact thoroughly documented by a Jew, and it needs to be understood that they put politics ahead of profit, and their politics are always anti-white. We're allowing an enemy alien to control mass media and use it to destroy our society and the race that built it. That's what all this sums up to. And there's a big mid-page graphic on 143 of Hollywood versus America and a picture of Michael Medved, a grinning Jew from California, I believe. The explosive bestseller that shows how and why the entertainment industry has broken faith with its audience. Quote from Rush Limbaugh, Michael Medved has written an amazing book, informative, important, insightful, and always great fun to read. In our ongoing culture war, Hollywood versus America hits its targets with the force of a multi-megaton bomb. Megaton bomb, Rush Limbaugh. Yeah, he left the Jew part out. But Garland has supplied it, so we have the true understanding of what's going on. If you understand Jews and their agenda, you can not only interpret all current day media, but all past history and how it's framed in textbooks. When you know where they want to go, you know what kind of lies they're going to tell. To draw further contrast between these years, it's worth noting that in 1965, the Academy Award for the Best Picture went to the G-rated, family-friendly musical, The Sound of Music, and in 1969, the very first year after Breakdown of the Code, it went to United Artists' disturbing X-rated film Midnight Cowboy, with faggotry, drug use, etc. Midnight Cowboy was directed by the Jew John Schlesinger, and features multiple scenes of homosexuality and other perversions, including one where the, quote, cowboy character, meant to symbolize the quintessential masculine, heterosexual, white American male, is forcibly sodomized. The year 1969 also saw the founding of the first explicit hardcore porn advocacy group, the Adult Film Association of America, of which David Friedman, the aforementioned Jew of sexploitation fame, was elected president 5 times. The popularity of sexploitation films had waned quite significantly by that time due to the fact that hardcore porn featuring actual sex was now becoming more acceptable. In January of 1968, the Swedish countercultural sex film I Am Curious, parentheses, Yellow, had been seized by customs after being imported by the Jew Barney Rosset, who, as we discussed in depth in Part 4, had been at the forefront of the major landmark obscenity cases in regard to banned books in the mid-60s, Lady Chatterley's Lover and Tropic of Cancer specifically. Here's graphics for I Am Curious Yellow, basically softcore porn. I Am Curious Yellow featured multiple scenes of nudity and simulated sex, including one where the lead actress is shown kissing a flaccid penis. Rosset paid Sandrews, the Swedish film company that produced I Am Curious Yellow, $100,000 in order to secure American distribution rights for the film and agreed to pay them 30% of its profits. He also promised to pay all legal fees should the film run into trouble, boasting that he, quote, may win for the film industry the same freedom afforded literature in the Lady Chatterley's Lover case. Being the first movie that featured sex and nudity to be shown in regular theaters, rather than in back-alley porn theaters, viewers flocked to see I Am Curious, Yellow. By September 1969, it had already grossed $5 million. A month later, it became the first foreign language film to top Variety's list of the top grossing films. Predictably, the film became the subject of many obscenity trials across the country. It was shown in 53 cities and contested in 15, ultimately getting banned in about 10 states. And there's a small montage graphic of headlines. Getting furious over curious. I Am Curious ruled obscene in Boston. Justices agree to review I Am Curious Yellow. The second U.S. Court of Appeals eventually overturned the New York customs ban, but this was not a nationwide ruling, as those, of course, only come from the Supreme Court. When the Supreme Court did finally hear the case, it ended with a 4-4 split. Justice William O. Douglas, who was a radical First Amendment, quote, absolutist, had recused due to a conflict of interest. Some of his anti-censorship writings had been featured in Rossett's journal, The Evergreen Review. Then there's a picture of Gerald Ford and the caption holding up a magazine open to a story, a portfolio of photographs by Arthur Freed, showing a woman lying naked on her side. Caption reads, "Future President Gerald Ford holding up the issue of Evergreen Review, which featured the anti-censorship writings of Justice William O. Douglas, in a move to have him impeached from the Supreme Court." The split upheld the lower court's ruling by default, and though this still did not overturn decisions in other parts of the country, it nevertheless spelled the end of the censorship of I Am Curious Yellow, as it became clear the issue would never be decisively resolved in the censor's favor. Altogether, the film earned Rossett an astonishing $14 million, but ironically, by paving the way for true pornography, it undercut the agenda of his publishing company, Grove Press. "I Am Curious Yellow was a big success," he said in an interview, quote, "but it was a disaster for us in many ways, because we made a lot of money. I went and bought a lot of foreign films, which were no longer commercially viable because all the art theaters had closed down overnight in 1970. They had started showing X-rated porno films. There had been a big market for foreign films in this country, and suddenly it was gone. After I Am Curious Yellow played, that was the end. We killed our own market." So basically they were going abroad to get foreign sort of smutty, softcore porn, since they couldn't do the real thing. But the second they could do the real thing, ironically, as a result of the cases filed and lost against I Am Curious Yellow, all of a sudden they go to heart. Who wants a hand on your thigh when you can have, you know, full body sex? If they can get hardcore sex on movies, they don't want the softcore stuff. And that was the stuff that his Grove Press was putting out. In the first post-Curious above-ground pornographic films, Andy Warhol's Blue Movie, 1969, and Mona the Teenage Nymph, 1970, the sex was shown while the man had a flaccid penis, carefully following the I Am Curious Yellow precedent, and then it progressively became more graphic. By 1972, the infamous full-on hardcore porno Deep Throat was a nationwide theatrical blockbuster, earning over $100 million, and staying on Variety's list of top 10 highest-grossing movies for 48 weeks. Deep Throat was soon followed by the similarly successful Behind the Green Door, 1972, and The Devil and Miss Jones, 1973. A nationwide backlash to these and other liberal excesses swept conservative Republican Richard Nixon into power in 1969, and there was a last-ditch effort to stem the tide of hardcore pornography. This effort, which culminated in the Nixon-Stack Supreme Court's 1973 Miller decision, the precedent of which still stands as the test for obscenity today, and the preeminent Jewish role in this hardcore pornography from then up to the present time, will be the topic of Part 9. E. Michael Jones has more about that and other court decisions as they tried to fight this, but somehow, if all these, it really is like another metaphor, messing with a plant that has 15 different shoots. By messing around with the flowers in each one, instead of grabbing the thing by the taproot and pulling it fully out of the soil so that it dies, you got to deal with Jews as a tribe, not the specific nasty manifestations of their awful anti-white behavior. Again, that's not me saying that. That's me simply as a vehicle for obvious, undeniable, factual, fact-based, evidence-based, history-based logic. That will close Section 8 on Jews and film. I want to thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll finish up Merchants of Sin by Benjamin Garland.